even though the Passover Seder is it's about memory, it's about remembering what happened, it's also very forward-looking and saying, because you delivered us back then, God, you will deliver us in the future. So to me, those forward-looking parts have always been very uplifting and inspiring.
On In Good Faith, we believe that all faith traditions have something to teach us about how God is working in the world and in our lives. So join us as we listen and learn. Today on In Good Faith, I'm speaking with Rabbi Evan Moffick about the symbolism of Passover, the whole week of celebration, as well as the meal. I'm in studio with our senior producer, Heather Bigley.
Hello.
Also, our student producer, Josh Orton.
How's it going?
Josh, as you were looking for someone to talk to about the meaning of Passover, what drew you to Rabbi Moffick?
What drew me to Rabbi Moffick was that he was really focused. All of his books, all of his works were really focused at building bridges and understanding, particularly between Jewish people and people who are Christian. And so I was really interested in why he felt such a desire to get people to understand more about their Jewish faith and traditions.
Rabbi Evan Moffick is the senior rabbi with Makem Solel Lakeside, a Reform congregation in Chicago. He's also the author of the 2015 book, What Every Christian Needs to Know About Passover, and he's a graduate of Stanford University. He's going to talk about Judaism as a faith, also as a culture, interesting distinction, and why I should care as a Christian, why Passover is part of my own tradition.
Yeah, I love that. And I love this idea that if we explore those roots of Judaism that gave birth to Christianity, we as Christians will have stronger faith.
I started by asking him, what's the most important thing he thinks he shares about Passover?
I think the most useful things that I've shared are the Jewish interpretations of the different symbols. One of the beautiful things about Judaism is that it is never a literalist religion. Even the Orthodox, there's always commentary, there's always interpretation, because the underlying idea is that God gave us this text to speak to us in our time and place. And the text has so many meanings. And when we discover a new meaning, we're simply uncovering what God had intended all along. Mm. So, for example, the matzah, the unleavened bread, seeing that as a sign of humility, that the bread is unleavened, it didn't have time to rise, it didn't have time to puff up, like we puff up our egos. And part of the purpose of Passover is to cultivate that humility before God, just like Moses, who was the most humble man on earth. Another interpretation is the Hebrew word, Mitzrayim, that means Egypt in Hebrew. But the root of Mitzrayim is the word tsar, which means narrow. And so the journey from Egypt is the journey out of narrow places in our mind, narrow places in our soul, narrow places in our world. So it deepens the experience that it's not just about going through the motions of reading these prayers and eating these foods. It's actually a spiritual journey, and that's captured in the language itself. And these commentaries are ways of deepening the meaning of the text. In fact, one year we did a mini Seder for people in AA.
Interesting.
Who are dealing with addiction. And that leaving the narrow places was something that I think resonated deeply. So it just shows how these religious ideas can be applied to so much.
For people who might not know, Passover is a meal. Could you talk about some of the things that would be on the table, the foods, and some of the symbolism?
Yeah. It's a very ritualized meal, and the symbolism is meant to remember the Exodus from Egypt. So the primary symbol is matzah, which is just unleavened bread. It's crunchy bread. And the idea is that the Jewish people had to flee Egypt so quickly before Pharaoh changed his mind, which he did change his mind. They were right to be suspicious of it, that they didn't have time to let their bread rise. So they had to take the bread before it could rise, and it was crunchy. So that's to remember the haste with which we left Egypt. Then there's the bitter herbs, which is, you know, it's called maror. It's horseradish. And that's to remember the bitterness of slavery. Mm. Or there's a shank bone. You don't eat that, but it's on the Seder plate. And that's to remember the Passover lamb, because before it was a ritualized, well, before the temple was destroyed in 70 CE, the ritualized meal was a lamb, a paschal lamb. And so now the temple's gone, so we don't eat a paschal lamb, but the shank bone is a memory of that. It's a symbol of that. You have the egg, or a hard-boiled egg typically, which symbolizes springtime. Passover is a time of renewal. You have salt water, which are the tears of slavery. You have parsley, which is springtime, again, because Passover tends to happen in the spring. Charoset, which is a mix of nuts and apples, and you know, there you can add in different things. But that's the mortar that was used, that the Israelites had in their hands to make bricks of slavery. Then there are other foods that we eat, you know, that are sort of the substance of the meal. You have gefilte fish, which is just a custom. That's a Jewish tradition. Oftentimes people have brisket. But the underlying, probably the most important thing to remember about the food is you don't have any bread. You don't have any bread products. Well, leavened bread. You don't have any of that for a week. That's sort of the way of infusing this memory of the Exodus into our hearts.
So I have a Jewish friend in Israel who near Jerusalem who always says to me, and don't forget the cups of wine.
Yes,
so
I should
ask you.
Four cups of wine.
Okay, and what are they for? What's their purpose?
Well, for the four promises of redemption. So the number four is really significant in Passover overall. There are 400 years of slavery. Four times redemption is promised in Exodus. Four children, the four questions. So you also have four cups of wine. And wine symbolizes sweetness in Judaism. It also symbolizes holiness, that in the ancient Near East, there were many religions that used wine for sacramental purposes, but it was kind of associated with idolatry. And so Judaism took wine, this symbol of idolatry, but made it a symbol of holiness. And so wine is consumed on special occasions to mark the holiness of this day. Just like a little bit of wine is consumed on the Sabbath to mark the Sabbath, wine is consumed on Passover to mark the holiness of this day.
I'm wondering, of all those symbols that you've just described to us, are there particular ones that maybe have always been most meaningful to you, or have there been times when one sort of stood out to you because of life circumstances and was really meaningful?
I think, to me, the haroset has always been a wonderful symbol. I don't know, it's sweet, and maybe I just, you know, as a kid, liked the sweetness of it. And the haroset and the egg, because I think they represent optimism and hope, and that, yes, we remember the bitterness of slavery, but the bitterness is always in the context of future joy. And there's a beautiful song that is sung at every Passover Seder called Dayenu. And that means it would have been enough. We would have been satisfied. We would have been happy. And it goes through all the things that God has done for the Jewish people. And after every one of them, it says, that would have been enough. But then, God, you did this. And that would have been enough. But then, God, you did this. So it's this beautiful prayer of gratitude. And at the end, there's kind of a messianic vision that in the end of days, you know, you will bring redemption to the world. So it's a very forward-looking, even though the Passover Seder it's about memory. It's about remembering what happened. It's also very forward-looking in saying, because you delivered us back then, God, you will deliver us in the future. So to me, those forward-looking parts have always been very uplifting and inspiring.
Yeah, that makes sense. The hope, gratitude, joy, beautiful words to grow out of a remembrance of difficult times.
Yes.
If I can quote you to you, in your book, here's a little quote, that through Passover, they seek to experience the blessing of freedom and not the pain of victimhood. How would experiencing the blessing of freedom, how would that apply today?
I think it's gratitude. I mean, one of the great things about Passover is remembering that we live in a place of religious freedom. In America, we have a lot of problems right now. It's a lot of tensions and issues and conflicts, but truly, we can practice our religion freely and be supported in it and find community. And when you sit around a Passover table, sometimes I think about times in Jewish history where Jews couldn't participate in Passover, when they had to do it in secret and couldn't invite Christian friends over. And so I think that to be in that place of freedom, to know that the future will be brighter. I mean, there's you traditionally end the Passover Seder as next year in Jerusalem. And so that's, yes, it is a literal hope that next year we can be in Jerusalem for Passover, but it's also symbolic that Jerusalem is the city of peace, the place of peace. May the world be more peaceful next year. May we be in a different space of more hope, more kindness, more love. That sort of hope underlies the Seder. And that to me is what it means to be free, to not dwell on being victims, although Jews were victims, but to dwell, to hope, to yearn for that place of freedom.
You have an interesting invitation in the book, which was for people who aren't Jewish to explore the roots of their faith. And I'm thinking what comes to mind is perhaps Christians who spend a lot of time in the New Testament, but maybe not so much in the Old Testament. As people look towards those deeper roots, what do you think they'll find, or are you hoping they'll experience?
I think they'll find great meaning. I mean, I've spoken at probably by now hundreds of churches. And I think the underlying vision or goal is that people know Jesus was Jewish. And if you want to be close to Jesus and to know what Jesus experienced and when Jesus was on earth, know Judaism, know the religion that he was born into and that his community was part of and that his disciples belonged to. And so when you learn about Judaism, you can grow deeper, closer to Jesus and deeper in your own knowledge and faith. So that's part of it. The other part is just, it's interesting. We live in a world where organized religion, faith is declining. And so when you can deepen your own sense of faith and just general knowledge of religious texts and stories, it's uplifting, it's inspiring. You know, when I visit churches and I'll sit in on worship, I feel inspired, even though it's not my religion. I feel uplifted by hearing the letters of Paul or, you know, something else. So I think that's part of it. So it's the knowledge and the closeness, but it's also just the experience of learning from another person's faith. I mean, a lot of this stuff used to be taught in schools and public schools. It isn't anymore. Yeah. So this is another place where we can deepen our own sense of spirituality.
It seems to me that often when people are teaching something, they gain even more understanding. Like that's how you know know something is as you teach it or if you can teach it. Have you had a deepening of understanding of your own faith as you explain it to people of other faiths?
Yes. I've written several books, and one of them was about the Jewish holidays, Jewish holidays for Christians. It was a lot of work, and I uncovered parts about the holidays that I had never really thought about. I'd experienced the holidays, but when I really went into their history and their different practices, like, and there's even, in the Passover book, I talk about Yemenite Passover practices where they dress in a certain way. I had never experienced any of this growing up. So in some ways, the research and the teaching and the questions that I got from different people kind of pushed me to go deeper in my own faith, for sure. It's wonderful. It's definitely, in some ways I compare it to, I meditate regularly, and that practice, that discipline has deepened my own feeling in prayer as well, in traditional Jewish prayer. So I think that there is something when we go deep into a topic to teach it, that it opens up different parts for us.
We're speaking specifically of what Christians need to know about Passover. Is there something you wish people in general who may not be informed knew about Judaism?
Judaism is not really a religion. It is a religion, but it's more than that. It's a people. Mm-hmm. It's a community. It's a culture. It's a way of life. The category of religion versus secular doesn't really apply in Judaism. And I think that is a confusing, that's, many Jews are confused about that too. But the if you go to Israel, for example, which I'm sure some of your listeners have, you see that about 75 to 80% of the population are not religious. They don't observe the Sabbath. They don't follow the dietary laws, but they consider themselves proudly Jewish. And it's because they're part of a people. And I think that is confusing sometimes to Christians. Mm. And it affects how we look at the state of Israel today. So remembering that Judaism is as much a people as a religion is something I think some people just kind of intuit, they get it, but understanding it formally, I think, can be very helpful to people.
You're listening to In Good Faith. We'll be back with more. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I'm Stephen Cap Perry, host of the In Good Faith podcast, and I want to tell you about another in our family of BYU radio podcasts, an award-winning show with an award-winning host. This is Julie Rose on Top of Mind. Do you get turned off by the news because of how angry and polarizing and even depressing it can be? Doesn't anybody know how to have a civil conversation or weigh two competing ideas without a knee-jerk reaction that if you don't think what I think, you're a bad person? Check out the podcast, Top of Mind. They take one tough topic and they dive deep. And the goal is learning how to stay open and curious, even when you're confronted with different perspectives that may challenge us. Learning how to stick with the discomfort until we feel like we've actually learned and gotten some understanding. We may change our minds, we may not. But every episode will leave you feeling hopeful and empowered to become a better advocate for what does matter to you. Top of Mind, listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is In Good Faith, speaking right now with Rabbi Evan Mothick about Passover and its symbolism. So that leads me to, were you raised in a religious home? And then what made you decide that you needed to reach out to other faiths and do some explanation and create understanding?
Yeah, I was raised in a Jewish home, and my parents, my whole family was active in the synagogue. In fact, I went to a Jewish day school, which was not very common at the time because I'm a Reform rabbi. So that's the more liberal branch of Judaism, and not many Reform Jewish kids go to day school. Mm. But it happened to be a great school that was in our neighborhood, and it was wonderful. So I learned Hebrew as a kid. I was involved in the synagogue as a kid, and that kind of set the path. I mean, I didn't know I was going to become a rabbi, but after completing rabbinical school, I was at a synagogue in downtown Chicago, and we were two blocks from a very large, very active Presbyterian church, and we did a lot of programs with them together. And it just resonated. They asked me to teach a class, and the class became very popular. And so I taught another class, and then we decided to have an interfaith Seder. Mm. Because Passover has always been a meal where you would invite people of different faiths. It's a part of the Christian story too. I mean, the Exodus from Egypt is part of the Bible. And so that kind of opened the door to really this passion that I was really able to develop. And being in an urban area with lots of different faiths, I think, helped cultivate that. The fact that many Jews marry people of different religions. And so that actually, as I was performing weddings, I would interact with both members of and ministers of people of other faiths. And there was just a great openness. And in fact, right now, we see rising anti-Semitism in the world. These relationships that I've built with other clergy and people of other religions are, I think, really helpful. They set a tone for real civil and meaningful conversation.
Yeah. Do you feel support from those other congregations as far as anti-Semitism when it happens?
Yes, very much so. I mean, not everybody. And there are certainly political tensions come in often. And, you know, I try to shy away from those as much as I can and focus on the ties that bind us. But yes, I mean, since October 7th and what happened, many friends reached out to me and I was very touched by it.
I'm wondering, was there some point at which you had to translate what you'd been taught, what you'd learned, both synagogue and the day school, and decide, am I a believer or what is my relation to God and the divine?
Yeah. I mean, I'm an intellectual guy. I love reading theology. I love reading modern Jewish history and thought. But I've always had a kind of basic faith. Mm. I've always felt a kind of majesty and awe when I go into a synagogue. I feel a connection to other people, to something bigger than ourselves. It's almost an awareness, a feeling that we're here for a purpose. I never really worked on it in terms of developing my own theology. I mean, I've talked about things that I believe and question and so forth. But on the deepest level, I think it's just always been there from childhood. I almost think you have to have that if you're going to be a faith leader. Now, some people would disagree. I know some rabbis who really have a much more kind of rationalist, non-theistic notion of God, but that's never been me. Mm. It's something I'm happy to talk about and appreciate, but I think it just came growing up and from my parents. You know, they've always had a deep sense of faith, so I think I inherited some of that.
What do you think gives you the most joy in your faith life?
Teaching. Study and teaching. The two go together. Mm. I have a regular Bible study group. We call it Torah Study at my synagogue. And it's just so nourishing. Every week we get together. Sometimes we'll get through an entire chapter. Sometimes we only get through one verse. But we really go deep on the text. What does this mean? How does it resonate for you? How does this apply to your life? What are the different interpretations? Talking about all of that is deeply nourishing to me spiritually. And of course, I love prayer. I love song and music. That's all part of it. But I think what really touches my soul is deep study and transformation. Also, as a rabbi, when I get to experience life cycle events, conducting a funeral or a wedding or a bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, that also just nourishes me spiritually.
You really get to be part of people's lives, important moments.
It's such a blessing.
So at what point did it occur to you first, maybe I'm going to be a rabbi, that this may be my path?
I think the thought first came to me when I became a bar mitzvah at age 13. And I really looked up to the rabbi and I thought he was just such a wonderful human being and leader. So I think it crossed my mind then, but I thought I'd go to law school or maybe, you know, become a history professor. I had a couple of wonderful mentors in college, both professors who encouraged me to deepen Jewish study and rabbis who said it could be something that you could do. And I thought to myself, this could be a truly meaningful way of life. And then I saw that it combined everything I loved, study, teaching, community building, prayer, relationships, all of that could really find expression in the rabbinate. So I just kind of got lucky. And, you know, some people who want to go into become clergy or, you know, are discouraged by their parents. My parents were thrilled. They were very encouraging and loving about it. So I think I was very fortunate.
That's nice. Do they happen to both be still with us?
Yes. They live in Milwaukee, whereas I'm in Chicago. So I don't see them all the time, but they come for events and holidays and things, which is wonderful.
Well, they must be very proud.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And of course, they've got granddaughters to come visit too.
Well, that's the main draw for sure.
You mentioned Seder that you did for a group. Mm-hmm. So you're not just explaining the meaning and the symbolism, but actually in some ways reenacting. How do you feel about various groups, which could include Christians, having something like a Passover Seder? Is it disrespectful, or is presenting the elements and talking about them? What should we be aware of so we're not, I guess the word we use today is culturally appropriating, but that we're not trying to enact a ceremony that's not ours?
This is a very controversial issue. And it actually, I had some pushback against me when the book came out, because the truth is, I think it's okay. Mm-hmm. There are many rabbis who don't think it's okay, but I think it's okay with the proper guidance. I don't want somebody just looking up Passover on Wikipedia and printing it out and saying, this is what we're supposed to do. You know, that I think is too simplistic.
Yeah.
But the Passover story is part of the Christian Bible as well. So I think it's okay. And I think it's okay to add different meanings to it. To me, cultural appropriation would be pretending that it's not a Jewish ritual, or saying our Seder supersedes the Jewish Seder.
Oh.
But that's not what I've seen Christian Passover Seders do. I've seen them mostly because I've participated in them. I've helped them at Catholic churches, at Protestant churches. I see just a deep appreciation. I want to experience the Jewish Passover and do it in a Christian setting. And to me, that's okay. The book actually at the very end has a kind of template for a Passover Seder for a church. Again, that got me a little criticism. You know, in fact, it was interesting. I actually debated a couple of more conservative rabbis about this. But the other way I look at it is this is going to happen anyways. Might as well have an educated approach to it. So that's one of the reasons I provided that Seder, so that people who are doing it don't just print off something they find on a random website. Yeah. They have something that is rooted in Jewish tradition.
That was Steve talking to Rabbi Evan Mofik about Passover. One of the things that I really liked was the different symbolic meanings that Passover includes. I think we live in a generation and a time where symbolism isn't really a thing anymore. Like, we could read Moby Dick and just say, oh, that's a good story about a whale, and that's it. But symbolism is super essential to Passover, and I really love that. Everything from what food they eat to the number of cups of wine, everything has some symbolic meaning, which I think brings Passover a richness and brings a lot of joy and meaning to those who celebrate it.
Yeah, and I actually found this really humbling. I mentioned to you guys, if someone were to ask me about Christmas Day and all the things we did to Christmas Day that connected to the story of the Christ child, I might be able to talk about some presents that we give out. But most other things in my very Americanized, probably too capitalistic Christmas have more to do with me having a really great time than they do with a ritualized remembrance of who Jesus is and what he's doing in my life. So this example from our Jewish friends, I think, is really important for us to pay attention to.
Interesting to me how he talks about Judaism as both a religion or a faith, but also a culture or a people. And so sometimes people assume if you say you're Jewish, then you must live every dietary law, observe every holiday, but you might not necessarily do that.
Yeah.
That you could be more on the secular side, but your identity is Jewish, or it could be your faith, or it could be both. And I think it's a beautiful tribute to this Passover meal and its symbolism that it has helped people for generations and generations understand the roots of where they came from, even that the smallest children would ask and get the answer to the question. And that's part of why they have this identity that has lasted through thousands of years. Many thanks to Rabbi Evan Mofik for speaking with us. This episode was produced by Heather Bigley and Josh Orton. Our production team also includes Leah King, Katerina Martinich, and Ashton Rowan. Our post-production sound designers are Mark Hansen, Brandon Lewis, Daniel Phillips, and Carly Wilson. In Good Faith is committed to the idea that we all benefit from hearing people of widely varying backgrounds share their personal experience with faith and belief. In fact, we think people with such experience deserve some of our best listening. If interfaith understanding is important to you, be sure and leave a comment or a review on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter at InGoodFaithPod, on Instagram and Facebook, InGoodFaithPodcast. Our YouTube channel is youtube.com/@in-good-faith. In Good Faith is a production of BYU Radio. I'm Stephen Cap Perry. I hope you join me again soon, right here, In Good Faith.